This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the importance of vaccinations with Dr. Paul Roumeliotis. We'll find out why gluten intolerance isn't what you think it is with health and wellness researcher David Nelson. We'll discover permaculture with landscaper and author Brandy Hall. And lastly, we'll learn about a cancer journey with screenwriter and author Kara Lockwood. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. CBD, the compound many people use in oils, lotions, and creams to ease pain and discomfort, has become very popular over the last decade. In that past decade, CBD products have shown up almost everywhere. And while CBD doesn't cause a high, scientists still don't fully understand how it works in the brain or body. In fact, the FDA only approves CBD for certain types of epilepsy and warns against using it during pregnancy. A research team led by Dr. Quanhong Wang at the University of Rochester wanted to learn more about how CBD affects the nervous system. Working with Harvard and Boston Children's Hospital, they found a way to deliver CBD directly to the brain in mice to help with nerve pain. Their biggest challenge was the blood-brain barrier, which normally blocks CBD from getting inside. To solve this, the team created a special formula called CBD-IN. It wraps CBD in tiny, water-friendly molecules so it can reach the brain more easily. In tests, it reduced nerve pain within 30 minutes without causing balance, memory, or movement problems. It also worked again and again without losing its effect. Even more interesting, CBD-IN didn't use the usual cannabinoid receptors. Instead, it changed electrical and calcium signals in nerve cells, calming only the areas that were overactive. Researchers say this approach could help create safer, more targeted treatments for chronic pain and possibly other brain disorders. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Paul Roumeliotis in a minute. But first, a little bit of business.
Canadians, we are tough. We shovel before work even begins. We fall, we get up. It's part of the game. We plunge without realizing it's even polar. And even the ones who aren't as tough as they used to be are still tough. Let's stay tough, Canada. We don't have time for COVID. Visit spikevax.ca to book your COVID vaccine appointment today. Spikevax is used to prevent COVID-19 disease caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Like all vaccines, 100% protection cannot be guaranteed and adverse reactions may occur. Talk to your healthcare professional to see if Spikevax is right for you.
Dr. Paul Roumeliotis, also known as Dr. Paul, has been the Medical Officer of Health of the Eastern Ontario Health Unit since 2007. His clear science-based guidance during the COVID-19 pandemic played a vital role in increasing public trust and vaccine uptake across the region. Dr. Paul continues to help communities make informed decisions about their health and well-being by providing health information that's timely, accessible, and easy to understand. Welcome to the show, Dr. Paul. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Yourself, Jamie?
I'm doing pretty well. I have to tell you, though, when I saw what we were talking about today, it reminded me it's time for me to get my vaccinations. Is COVID still something that we need to be concerned about this fall and winter?
Well, you know, COVID is still there. I can tell you that we've had several outbreaks across Ontario. And the good news is, though, that it's actually on the decrease. So short answer is yes. We're still concerned about COVID, particularly the elderly and people with underlying medical conditions. But it is on its way down, but it's still around. And we believe that it's going to be around in a seasonal way for years to come.
So much like influenza.
Yeah.
The current strains that are prevalent, are they similar to what we were last experiencing over the last couple of years? Or Or is there any new twists that we need to be aware of?
Well, there's still the Omicron kind of progeny that we call, you know, the great grandkids of that original one. And there's still some small variants, and they do tend to change every year. And so last year's version is a bit different than this year's version. And consequently, the vaccine has adapted as well to be able to sort of catch up with what's the latest sub-strain that's out there and circulating.
So it's much the same as the influenza vaccines in that those who are creating the vaccines are anticipating the mutations and trying to get in front of it, right?
Exactly. In fact, it's going to be like that moving forward.
So if somebody had their vaccination last year, do they need to get a vaccination this year?
Yes, they do. That's a good question. Yes, they do. Because of the fact that last year's vaccine will not be a perfect match for this year's version, similar to what we talk about with the influenza vaccine and the influenza viruses that change every year, it's the same thing. So just because you got your COVID shot last year does not mean you'll be fully protected against the circulating strain. So in fact, we do recommend getting an annual shot. In fact, the latest recommendation was for individuals 65 and over, and particularly those who have chronic medical conditions, should actually be receiving it still twice a year.
What about those people who are under 50? Do they still need to get the vaccine?
Well, you know, COVID had been quite dangerous to the individuals who were 65 and over, particularly 70, 75 and over. But I would say that to be safe, I would recommend it. If you ask me who should be getting it, who is under 50, I would say individuals who have chronic underlying medical conditions, because the two primary targets of COVID were individuals who were 65, 70 years of age or older, and individuals less than that who had chronic underlying medical conditions, you know, heart disease, diabetes, and those type of things. And so, yes, if you're less than 50, and particularly if you have underlying medical conditions, you should consider getting your COVID vaccine as well.
Do those conditions include those who are immunocompromised?
Yes. In fact, the individuals who are immunocompromised are included in the individuals who would need that extra protection, despite the fact that they're not older than 65.
Can I get my COVID shot at the same time as flu or RSV?
Yes, you can. You can get it at the same time, different arms, or you can get it in the same arm but different locations. So yes, there's absolutely no reason not to be able to get them together. In fact, we're hoping that moving forward, the manufacturers of these vaccines will actually come up with a vaccine that has both flu and COVID in one shot. It's like it's two separate shots.
It's like a multivitamin. Sometimes when I get these vaccines, I kind of feel, for lack of a better word, crappy for a day or two. Is that common, or is that just a function of me being a unique individual?
Well, what happens is there are mild side effects. You know, we're injecting, when you get a vaccination, we're injecting something that looks like a virus, you know, into one's body. So the body reacts. The body, that if you're not feeling well, it means your body's reacting to something and actually creating antibodies and creating protection for you. So it is a common thing to feel crappy, tired a day or two after the shot, the COVID shot or flu vaccine for that matter. But these are mild side effects that go away. And sort of that mild side effect is really outweighed by the potential risk of the infection itself.
If you're living with other people, does everybody in the household have to get the vaccine in order for there to be protection? Or is it like sort of like an individual situation?
That's an excellent question. And in fact, when you talk to me about people less than 50, I should have actually said as well that if you're living with people who have chronic medical conditions who are more prone to severe complications of COVID, and for that matter, flu, for example, we do know that in individuals who have chronic medical conditions, particularly if they're older than 65, their immune system isn't as robust as somebody younger. And so vaccinating them will offer them protection. But because their immune system is not, optimal because of aging, they will not get optimal protection from the vaccine. And so it is important that the people around them, their household, are also protected so they can indirectly protect their vulnerable loved ones.
So ironically, as we're doing this interview, I'm getting notifications from my pharmacy that I can get the shot. So let's talk about access and cost.
Sure. For in Ontario, do we need to pay for these vaccines? And
no.
How do we best get them?
Well, in Ontario, the influenza vaccine and the COVID vaccine are covered for anybody that needs, that wants them. And we can get them either at your primary care office, a family doctor, if you have one. If not, pharmacies will provide both of those vaccinations and public health units as well across Ontario, and they are free of charge. When we're talking about RSV, we also have RSV vaccinations for the elderly as well. As of last year in Ontario, for individuals who are 60 plus living in a long-term retirement home, the RSV vaccination was free. This year, it's the same, but we're also adding individuals who are 75 years or older living outside of any congregate setting. They can also get their vaccination for free. Unfortunately, the RSV vaccine for the senior population is this year is not available in pharmacies. It's only available through your healthcare practitioner or your local public health unit. And I'm talking about Ontario.
And that's interesting because I've had people come on the show to say that, you know, with respect to RSV, there are efficacies in people 50, 55 plus getting the vaccine. In fact, I'm hearing commercials about it all the time.
Well, you know, when Health Canada recommends them, they recommend them based on studies. And so I believe that, you know, the older you are, the more prone you are. And that's why in Canada, in Ontario, we are actually looking at 60 plus in the congregate care settings and long-term care settings, because we know that's where a lot of outbreaks can occur. And in 75 plus. Personally, if I had my way, I would advocate for free vaccination, the RSV vaccine, for anyone 65 plus.
So, you know, we're talking about COVID, we're talking about RSV. There are so many different vaccines. Which are the most important?
Well, I think all of them are, I'll be honest with you. But if you're talking in the context of, and it also depends on the age group that you're talking about. If we're talking about the elderly population, the vaccines that I call the sort of circulating ones, you know, the ones that come back every year, influenza vaccination, as well as COVID and the RSV vaccine. Now, for the RSV vaccine, we know that the protection will last a couple of years, but so if you get it this year, you're probably good for a couple of years. Those are the three sort of what I call seasonal ones. But for elderly, there are two other vaccinations that are quite important. One is what's called the pneumococcal vaccination, which is a bacteria, pneumococcus or streptococcus pneumonia, is a bacteria that causes severe lung infections, pneumonia, all kinds of complications, particularly among the elderly. And that is available, again, in Ontario, free of charge for anybody over 65 or anybody under 65 with underlying medical conditions, including immunosuppression. And then the other one that is also available, again, for people over 65 is the shingles vaccination. Because again, shingles, as you get older, and for people who don't know, shingles is kind of a resurgence of chickenpox. When you had because when you get chickenpox as a child, for example, it, for some reason, it stays dormant in our nerves and then comes out as shingles with a typical pain. And we do know that there are some complications, including brain and even dementia after shingles. So there is another vaccine for people 65 and over for shingles.
So let's circle back to the flu vaccine for a moment. And we kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation. The people who prepare the vaccines are doing a little bit of guesswork. And obviously, it's an educated guess as to, you know, what's going to be prevalent.
Yes.
I was hearing rumors, and I've been trying to look into this, that we don't quite have the right match this year. Can you shed some light on that?
Sure.
Is that true? And if so, you know, how do we navigate this?
Well, it's partially true. And then we don't know until the season, you know, comes in, and then we look at the data and look at the, you know, the subtypes that are out there. But in general, we kind of base it on what happened in the Southern Hemisphere, like Australia, for example. And when we talk about a mismatch, we talk about the fact that, you know, despite our best guesses that we usually do, like, you know, early on in the year, like March of this past year, the viruses that are in there tend to change. And the more they change in terms of their antigens, the less the vaccine will be effective. That's not to say the vaccine won't be effective. So when we talk about a quote-unquote mismatch, instead of having, you know, 100, you know, high 80 or 90%, you know, efficiency, you're dropping down to maybe 30, 40%. And that's what that means. So it's hard for me to predict 100% that that's going to happen. But we do know that, you know, that's kind of what happened in Australia. And so when we talk about a mismatch, it means that the virus, since the time we, our best guess was produced, you know, in March, has changed a bit. And so we do know that that will be potentially a mismatch. However, if you ask me, I'd rather be 30, 40% protected than 0% protected, particularly if I'm prone to complications, and especially if you're over 65. So I like to, you know, I like to clarify that, yes, that is a potential mismatch, but it doesn't mean that you should say, ah, it's not worth getting it because it's not going to work. It will work partially, and it may be the difference between somebody getting the flu and ending up in hospital or not.
Okay. Some people may not be convinced who are listening to our discussion. If they were still on the fence, what would you tell them to motivate them to go get their COVID vaccine?
COVID, for sure, in an elderly individual or individual with underlying medical conditions, I would certainly recommend and talk about some of the complications. People do not realize that aside from the acute or sort of the immediate symptoms, you know, that you get cough, not feeling well, you can have longer term complications. A lot of these viruses, what they do is they cause inflammation in the body. And so that inflammation can be outside of the lungs. It could be in the heart, get a heart attack, get a stroke. So there are complications. So it's not just, oh, I'm going to get COVID, I'll get over it. And you also know that the people have long COVID as well, long-standing complications. So to me, that's a good reason to get it as well. If you're talking about influenza, there are some studies. In fact, there's going to be a guideline that's coming out next year that actually is recommending to physicians to strongly recommend flu vaccination every year to their patients, because of the fact that we know now that, again, influenza not only causes those acute hospitalizations, death, and so on that we see typically every year, but it also causes a lot of other things like frailty, increasing frailty in seniors, loss of independence, worsening of chronic illness, and something new that we know now, it can actually, influenza itself can actually cause heart attacks and stroke. And we know that vaccination will prevent those complications. So the latter thing that I just talked about, those last things are not well known. So these are the type of things we try to advocate about. You know, if you're sick, particularly if you're an elderly individual, regardless if it's COVID or if it's flu, it can be quite disturbing to your life, loss of independence, and potentially other non-lung complications that can be prevented by vaccine.
Some people are worried about the side effects from the COVID vaccine. Is there anything that we should know that will provide some clarity?
I can tell you that after millions and millions of doses, you know, the side effects that we've seen, the side effect profiles that we've seen are your typical side effects, not feeling well, like we said, crappy and you know, lousy for a couple of days, bit of fever. For the most part, the rare complications, the rare serious complications that we see are quite rare. And so if you look at on the basis of, you know, the risk of getting vaccinated versus the risk of not getting vaccinated, certainly the risk of not getting vaccinated is higher than the risk of getting vaccinated. So it's always a balance between the two. But again, if you're, you know, if you know that you can prevent, you know, heart attacks or stroke or other complications, long COVID and so on, you know, the side effect that you'll have for a couple of days is well worth the price, let me tell you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Paul Roumeliotis. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss new research into gluten intolerance on The Tonic. Vitamins and minerals work to provide a supportive foundation for any healthy skincare regimen.
If you're looking for a supplement to help fill nutrient gaps for better skin, check out Canprev's newest formula, Aces Plus Zinc and Copper. This full-spectrum blend of both fat and water-soluble vitamins and minerals offer enhanced antioxidant action and provide relief from long-term topical issues. Trusted by Canadians for over two decades, Canprev provides over 200 high-quality natural health supplements for your unique health needs. Find Aces Plus Zinc and Copper, as well as other natural health products by Canprev at your local health food store. Visit canprev.ca to find a store near you.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
David Nelson is invited faculty at the Nova Center for Justice and Well-Being. He attended the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine and is a health food, retail, and wellness services business owner. He's written numerous academic articles, and he's a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, David. How are you?
Not too bad, Jamie. Not too bad at all. Nice to be back on the show. Nice to be chatting with you.
So interestingly, you know, you and I had an exchange away from the mic, where we both came across the same article regarding gluten intolerance. And it was news to me. You probably knew more about it than I did. And I thought it would be interesting to bring you on the show and discuss it. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we should probably start at the beginning. Can you clarify the difference between celiac disease, wheat allergy, and what's commonly called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, or NCGS?
Yeah. It's a really great question. Because they're all three are different. So celiac disease is an autoimmune condition. So that's the most important part. What that means is that when you eat something that contains gluten, which is a type of protein found in things like rye, wheat, and barley, it triggers your own immune system to attack you, very specifically at the lining of the small intestine. And this reduces your ability to absorb nutrients. Okay, so that's one. So celiac, autoimmune. Wheat allergy is an allergy. Mm-hmm. It's IgE mediated. So that's part of the immune system that increases or causes histamine and stuff that's like hives, swelling, wheezing, anaphylaxis sometimes, although that's far less common. They use a skin prick test for that. So with celiac disease, they might have to take a biopsy. There is a blood test now that they can do. But with wheat allergy, with IgE, they do a skin prick test. And then the big one that a lot of people know about is non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So I have a lot of customers in the store, and they believe that they have what's called non-celiac or non-wheat, non-gluten wheat sensitivity. When this rises is when celiac disease has been ruled out. So the doc, somebody, naturopathic doctor says you don't have it. There's no markers. We don't have any autoimmune markers. Wheat allergy has been ruled out. So there's no IgE response, but the person reliably, that's the important part, they feel worse when eating gluten-containing or wheat-containing foods, and they feel better when they're removed.
So the article in question that we both read suggests that for many people who believe that they're sensitive to gluten, so we're excluding the celiacs and those with the wheat allergies, the real culprit isn't actually the gluten, but maybe fermentable carbohydrates like fructans rather than the gluten itself. So is that accurate? Like, what does the article say about that?
Yeah, well, actually, so, I mean, this is actually the most important, I think, thing that we talk about here is that when they looked at this and they did, they challenged fructans versus gluten in people who already said, hey, I'm gluten sensitive. So that's what they said, I'm gluten sensitive. But in the trial, they challenged them with gluten and with fructans. And they did a double blind crossover, which means everybody got fructans, everybody got gluten, they'd had a washout period and they crossed them over. So everybody has the same thing with placebo and everything. Mm-hmm. Here's what they found out. And this is big. The symptoms people experienced were significantly worse with fructans than gluten.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So that's important. Now we know this. Monash University's done a lot of work on the FODMAP diet. Okay.
Right.
FODMAPs stands for low fermentable, essentially carbohydrates and other things. So it's fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, polyols. So like all the different types of carbohydrates that are fermentable. Some people who can't digest fructans, which are like fructose, but they're not, they're a small piece of that. Some of those people do way worse with fructans. And it's likely to do with their microbiome, creating inflammation in the gut.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about the gut-brain axis playing a role in this perceived gluten sensitivity. I don't want to say people are faking it, but is the response biochemical or is it psychosomatic according to the study?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's a really good question because here's the thing about this study. The gut-brain axis really is showing what's happening here, and it's bidirectional. So I want to be really I want to be really clear on this. What you eat can go into your digestive tract, change some things, and signal the brain in a way where the brain, let's just say, doesn't feel good. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the opposite is true. You can take in information and the brain can perceive something as not being good for you and create the conditions in the gut so that that thing won't, you won't feel well. Right? So we kind of call this, it's all in your head or all in your gut and there's a split. It's not. It's, there is a psychosomatic piece here that might not be biochemical. It might actually be your belief system around the food. So what did they find in the study? Here's what they found. They found that if you're told something has gluten, even when it doesn't, your perception will be that it was worse for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that people are faking it. They actually have the symptomology, but their mind might be creating this. We see this with the placebo. Your mind can create medicine, but the opposite is true. The gut can influence how you feel. So it's bidirectional. That's the most important part of that.
Okay, so within the study, and going back to the double-blind trials, it seems that only 16 to 30% of people classified as being gluten sensitive reacted specifically to gluten. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so that means people who have, you know, who have identified as NCGS, okay? So that's what we call it, non-celiac gluten sensitivity. They've identified as non-celiac gluten sensitive, may not be gluten sensitive. They may be fructan sensitive. So what I'll tell you is that I also have a clinic. So we have five naturopathic doctors. And one of the things that happens when we do these food sensitivity studies and food sensitivity screenings and we do elimination diets is that often people really truly respond to a low FODMAP diet.
Yep.
And that would capture that fructan piece in there. So we definitely see it. And here's the pattern in a sense. People who eat fructose have far more reproducible triggers than gluten for a share of the gluten sensitive folks. So that means there might be a new phrase that comes out now, which is, you know, fructan sensitivity as opposed to just gluten or wheat sensitivity.
So let's bring it into the practical realm.
Mm.
If somebody's experiencing symptoms like bloating, fatigue, brain fog, which is connected to what they believe is a gluten sensitivity, what steps should they take based on the research? Should they before they eliminate gluten from their diet?
Yeah, well, so you need to figure out, is it truly gluten? Is it FODMAPs? So, and then people who have a strong nocebo or placebo effect, what the expectancy of the outcome is,
mm-hmm.
those are all important, but let's really drill down on why this is happening. We have a high ultra-processed food diet with low fiber, high stress, low sleep, low exercise. This all contributes to the way that we process nutrition. And so people that are highly stressed are going to have a sensitive gut in the gut-brain axis. So what do they need to do? I mean, it's a good question. A, you need to figure out if you're celiac or not. So you get a blood test done.
Yep.
And you're going to know, and it's really important because you do greatly decrease how much you can absorb. Next, you got to keep it simple. You got to figure out what's making you worse, what's making you better. If you eat a big ultra-processed cereal breakfast, which might have a lot of fructans in it, and you feel terrible and you have a lot of gas and bloating, that's not the breakfast for you. You got to think about it in a little bit of a different way. And then you have to make sure, is there other things contributing to like how you're feeling? You have low iron, low B12, or you have sleep apnea, stuff like that. So it may not, quote unquote, just be gluten that you need to take out, but it's really important to recognize that often when you take gluten out of the diet, you are also taking out the fermentable carbohydrates that are actually causing the problem, right? You're not just taking gluten out, you're taking the whole thing out, all wheat, all rye, all barley. You know, that's part of the elimination diet, and you're actually removing fructans and gluten when you do that.
Okay. So we have time for one last question, and that is my understanding, and there's no reliable biomarker for non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
That's right.
And if that's true, what are people to do in terms of diet, support, and lifestyle?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would approach this pretty much like this. Okay, so let's talk about if you're celiac or you have an allergy, you need to go get that tested medically or with your naturopathic doctor. Naturopaths can't do the IgE, but they can test for celiac disease or your medical doctor. That's who tests for that. If you're really concerned about it, it's been a long time, you're low energy, your blood work just can't seem to normalize, you might want to get it tested. However, it's really important to notice in the gut-brain axis about this. So I'm gonna say it this way. If your nervous system is amplifying gut signals that your brain is hearing as quote unquote scary, that doesn't make it imaginary.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
It's still a real thing that you really have to deal with. You just may have to deal with it in a different way. Maybe you have a lot of stress or things around eating, gut brain axis, clean up your diet, eliminate ultra processed food. The bare minimum for fiber per person is about 30 grams a day. We only get 13 to 15 grams a day. That alone could make a huge difference on the sensitivity. So, people just need to, I think, would have a food journal, figure out what they're sensitive to, and potentially seek out professional help if they want help sorting through some of the blood work and other things to figure out where they're at.
And I would add, because this research is so brand new, you might even want to track it down, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Great. That's a great idea. So, let people follow up on it.
Exactly. And so you can inform your doctor or naturopath. They may not be aware of this study, and that might help things too. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Perfect.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely, Jamie. Always a pleasure.
That was David Nelson. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss permaculture on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit omegaalpha.com.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Vitamins and minerals work to provide a supportive foundation for any healthy skincare regimen. If you're looking for a supplement to help fill nutrient gaps for better skin, check out Canprev's newest formula, Aces Plus Zinc and Copper. This full-spectrum blend of both fat and water-soluble vitamins and minerals offer enhanced antioxidant action and provide relief from long-term topical issues. Trusted by Canadians for over two decades, Canprev provides over 200 high-quality natural health supplements for your unique health needs. Find Aces Plus Zinc and Copper, as well as other natural health products by Canprev at your local health food store. Visit canprev.ca to find a store near you.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Brandy Hall is the founder and CEO of Shades of Green Permaculture, a regenerative landscaping firm she launched in 2008. With a team of 25 full-time employees, she has worked with thousands of clients to design and implement landscapes at homes, schools, businesses, parks, and new developments. She has 2 decades of experience in off-grid water systems, landscape construction, and integrated farming systems. She's a frequent speaker at conferences and community events, including the Georgia Climate Conference, the United States Green Building Council's Chrysalis Awards, and the Native Plant Symposium. Named a 2023 Rising Star by My Home Improvement magazine, Hall also serves as mayor of Pine Lake, Georgia. Her company, Shades of Green, has been recognized in the top 10% of all B Corps globally as a Best for the World honoree since 2018. Welcome to the show, Mayor. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well today. Up here in Toronto, the leaves are falling, so I spent the weekend sort of clearing my garden. And we're here to talk about gardens today, and in particular, your book about permaculture. Can you explain what permaculture is to those who aren't familiar?
Yeah, absolutely. So permaculture is a system of integrating humans into the environment as active participants. That's how I like to think about it. So as we're thinking about that in a residential kind of context, it's how do we produce food, medicine, beauty, habitat, regenerate soil, work with stormwater, all of the things.
And why do you think permaculture is so important?
I think it's really important because, I don't know about you, but for me, sometimes the problems that we face globally feel very intractable. Like you start pulling on a thread and you can't really get to the bottom of it. And there's something that's very grounding about having your hands in the soil and knowing that you're making an impact with very small scale solutions that add up. Capturing carbon through soil, mitigating stormwater problems, which we have a lot down in the southeast where I'm located, by sinking the water in, replenishing groundwater and aquifers and all of the things that we can do just as contributors, as, you know, small scale residential homeowners. I think that it helps to ignite hope. It helps to feel like we're making contributions, and we are. To be active participants in the Earth's return to health.
Before we did this interview, I was explaining how I did a little bit of landscape architecture on my property. I pulled out all the grass because I thought, anything you have to do, you have to keep doing. So like watering and weeding, it just became a chore as opposed to something I was enjoying. And I replaced some of those with local plants and also pollinator plants, because I think it's also important we support all the pollinators who are so important to our ecosystem, but we seem to be sort of destroying through all the chemicals. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're getting at too with permaculture?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we like to talk about is planting ecosystems, not just plants. And so developing plant communities that feed humans, feed the soil, feed pollinators, feed songbirds, that's a really important part, choosing plants wisely, ideally for multiple functions within the landscape.
So sort of circling back to permaculture for a moment, there are 3 pillars of permaculture, as I understand it. Can you explain what they are for the listeners?
Yeah, so this is a framework that I've developed over the years to try to simplify it for the average homeowner, the average land steward. So depending on what book you read, there's tons of principles. There's lumpers and splitters, just like in the botanical world, of how many principles of permaculture. But I like to think of it as the 3 pillars of a regenerative landscape. And those are working with water as a resource. Water is the foundation and the framework of all living systems. So working with water as a resource to restore the water cycle, rather than sending water into the stormwater system that then turns into flash floods in our creeks, especially with increasing urban development. We're slowing it down and we're sinking it into the soil. And then that hydrates the soil. So the soil is the second pillar of a regenerative landscape. So creating closed loop systems where we're integrating waste as a resource to build our soil and to build our soil's organic content, which then builds the soil's capacity to be a sponge and to mitigate the effects of drought and flood. And then the final pillar of a regenerative landscape is building plant communities. So developing plant communities that bolster biodiversity, that help feed the soil, that, like, you know, we were just talking about, feed humans, feed songbirds, feed pollinators, and are playing a vital role in the ecosystem restoration.
It's interesting. Up here in Toronto, municipal council passed a bylaw which disconnected all the downspouts from the houses to the sewer drains. So, you know, it used to be that the water would run off into the sewers, but that actually doesn't happen anymore. They've all been disconnected with serious fines if you don't do it. And so the water runs off into everybody's yards, which I think is, do you have that? You're the mayor. Do you do that in your town or not?
Yeah. So, you know, we're blessed in the Southeast here in Atlanta. We get about 50 to 60 inches of rain a year. And so I moved to Atlanta in 2010. And at that point, it was actually illegal to harvest rainwater, which is interesting. But very quickly, you know, municipalities realized just how expensive it is to manage all of the water in the watershed at the bottom of the watershed, meaning our creeks, our stormwater drains. So most of the municipalities around us have taken measures to infiltrate, you know, beyond just disconnecting our downspouts, which is a wonderful thing to do, to implement best management practices for building rain gardens or capturing that water in some other way. So you're infiltrating the first inch of rainwater, you know, as opposed to having to take up the streets and spend millions and millions of dollars to increase the pipe sizes so that that can accommodate, you know, the next 15 years of growth. So I think a lot of municipalities are finally catching on that it's a lot less expensive to manage it at the home level than it is at the, you know, the municipal infrastructure level, you know, and it's just better all around.
So your notion of permaculture, it works in Georgia. Does it work up here in climates like we have in Toronto?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you can work with water, you know, the tools that you might use, the depths of pipes, for instance, or the types of winter drains you might put on rainwater harvesting tanks. Those are the details that will shift depending on your climate. But the overarching principles, the overarching pillars we were just talking about, you know, managing your water as a resource, building your soil's capacity to hold that water and to build up the organic content, and then choosing appropriate plants that have multiple functions within the landscape, that can be applied to any climate.
Do you have to be an experienced gardener to actually practice permaculture, or is it accessible to those who don't do much gardening at all?
It's absolutely accessible. You know, we have so many clients that just dive in, you know, they want to take out the grass. Exactly what you were saying at the beginning of this, like, it takes so much energy to have to go out and mow every week. And they're like, I have so many other things I could be doing with my time. And so, you know, all you really need is a shovel and some gumption.
Okay. Well, I certainly had that. Although by Toronto standards, I have a fairly big property, and it took me a whole season to do the conversion, just in the backyard. And like, I had to do the front yard separately from the backyard, you know, putting down the various layers to prevent the weeds from coming and all sorts of things. It was just a huge, huge job. So you say it's accessible, but I'm going to put you on the spot a bit. Can you describe some starter projects from your book that an average gardener would be capable of undertaking?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when we're talking about water, digging a swale, a contoured swale that's planted with plants, that doesn't need to be very large. You know, it can be 8 feet long by 2 feet wide and a foot deep. And that, you know, starting higher on the watershed, meaning higher up on the hill, to slow the water down that's coming from the downspout and just letting it sink in, and then planting that with beautiful pollinator gardens. You know, that's a weekend project. Or if we're talking about soil, starting a compost pile. In the book, I talk about all the different compost methods you can do that are influenced by your lifestyle and, you know, how much you want to interact with it for instance. So that could be anything from, you know, starting a brush pile in your yard so you have some habitat for small mammals, which attract nutrients and birds and all the things, to managing a, you know, a tumbler type of compost system, to even outsourcing your composting to like a curbside pickup type of service. And then with plants, that's really a matter of curating, you know, it could be planting a small container of flowering perennials or a slight herb garden, you know, around your mailbox. So any of those types of projects you can do.
Fantastic. Time for one last question. And that is, what are the key takeaway messages that you hope readers will get from your book?
I think the biggest one is that you don't have to be an expert to start. You can just go outside and observe and interact with your landscape and learn by doing. And another one is that, you know, we're all playing a part in this process of returning the earth to health in our tiny yards, you know, even if it's small impact in our own yard. When we're doing that and our neighbors are inspired by that, that adds up to really big impact. So we can all make a difference by the choices that we make in our landscapes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Canadians, we are tough. We shovel before work even begins. We fall, we get up. It's part of the game. We plunge without realizing it's even polar. And even the ones who aren't as tough as they used to be are still tough. Let's stay tough, Canada. We don't have time for COVID. Talk to your healthcare professional to see if Spikevax is right for you. Spikevax is used to prevent COVID-19 disease caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Like all vaccines, 100% protection cannot be guaranteed and adverse reactions may occur. Find additional product information at spikevax.ca.
The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Kara Lockwood is the USA Today bestselling author of more than 35 books, including The Takeover and I Do But I Don't, which became a Lifetime original movie starring Denise Richards. Her latest, There's No Good Book for This, But I Wrote One Anyway, The Irreverent Guide to Crushing Breast Cancer, blends memoir, humor, and practical advice for navigating diagnosis, treatment, and recovery. A breast cancer survivor, Kara endured a double mastectomy, chemotherapy, and reconstruction before going into remission in 2024. Fantastic. Half of all the book proceeds benefit breast cancer research. She's a native of Texas and lives in Chicagoland with her family and pet. And to learn more about her, you can go to theresnogoodbookforthis.com and KaraTheAuthor.com. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm good. I'm good. I'm in remission, so things are great.
Yeah, that's good news. What made you decide to write the book? There's no good book for this, but I wrote one anyway. Fantastic name.
Yeah. Well, when I was diagnosed in 2023, I felt like there weren't any good books for this, quite frankly, out there. There are a lot of serious books. There are a lot of big, giant medical phone books of information out there that are very serious and very studious and very terrifying. for anyone going through breast cancer. So I wanted to write a book with a little more levity, a little more humor, but also to show people that it's okay to be human during this process and have all of the feels, all the feelings of terror and anger and, you know, uncertainty, and to show people they're not alone. So that's why I wrote the book.
So in the book, you describe your journey starting with a routine mammogram that turned into something much bigger. Can you walk us through that moment and when things went from sort of like humdrum to ordinary to life-changing?
Yeah. You know, it was really a bolt out of the blue because cancer didn't run in my family. And, you know, I wasn't expecting cancer. I don't think anyone really is, but it really sort of hit me because I'd had many mammograms that came back fine. This one, of course, I had a biopsy, so it was a little unusual. But honestly, you know, I think most people don't expect bad news. I certainly wasn't. When I got that news, I was standing in my kitchen, you know, trying to figure out what to make for dinner. And it just threw my whole world upside down. I instantly went into a white room of panic. didn't really hear anything the doctor was telling me. So it really just completely overturned my life. I had all these things planned. A new romance book was releasing. And then, you know, suddenly everything had to be put on hold so that I could deal with cancer.
So you like me, lean into the humor. How's that help you process something as serious as breast cancer?
Yeah, I think humor is so very important because humor helps us take back our power and our agency. You know, it's hard to be terrified when you're laughing at something. I think it gives you a sense of control, even in situations where you don't feel like you have a lot of control, like a cancer diagnosis or sitting and getting chemotherapy or about to be wheeled into surgery. I think giving yourself permission to laugh is so important. I think during this time, I think a lot of people get hung up with, you know, this is serious and horrible and there can't be anything funny. And yet there are a million funny things that happen, absurd things that happen in doctor's offices. And I think giving yourself permission to laugh sort of helps you, you know, take back your agency. I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm sure, you know, in your life, humor just helps you get through those tough moments.
Definitely a coping mechanism. You write about the dreaded windowless office with the round table where bad news always seems to land. Why did you include that in your discussion and in your book? And it seems universal. Like, what is it about that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I think it's because when you're in that windowless room with the doctors, you feel trapped. And I think that's physically and mentally and metaphorically and spiritually. And I felt that including details like that could help bring it home for people who, you know, find themselves feeling that way. And my main point really was to help people feel like they were less alone and that they were seen and understood. And I think including details like that sort of helps bring in people who aren't familiar with it. And then for people who are familiar, it helps them, you know, feel like they're understood, like their journey is universal, which in many ways I feel it is.
Do you think that the doctors understand that? I mean, I've had some medical issues that I've dealt with over the last couple of years, not cancer, but where I had extended hospital stays. And I noticed, you know, like everybody, there's different personalities and different levels of empathy. What did you experience when you were going through it?
Yeah, you know, I think doctors do their best, at least most of them do, although, of course, there are exceptions. You know, it's interesting because I feel that the medical community in general tries to give people, you know, I think that windowless room, for example, is like, you know, this ideal of privacy and, you know, you're being held close, you know, for bad news. And I don't think a lot of, you know, perhaps organizers of that room might think about how it feels like a trap.
You know, it feels, of course.
And that when you're led into that room, it feels like, oh, no, it's bad news. It's, you know, it's sort of like when you're growing up and maybe your parents were going to ground you and perhaps they handle like you're going to sit at the dining room table and we're going to talk about it. And then when you saw that you were going to the dining room table, you're like, oh, no, this is going to be bad. You know, yeah. So it felt to me a little like that. I think, you know, I don't think that it's intentional. I think it just ends up happening in this process where, unfortunately, during, you know, that cancer journey, there's so many times you head back to that windowless room or that dining room table for some bad news. You know, it's not, it's not always good news. The good news is given to you right away, like as soon as possible. And the bad news is like, let's get you to a quiet place where we can go through all the horrible details. I think they try to do their best, you know, but,
When I saw Windowless Room, this is how dark I am. I thought it was because, you know, then you couldn't jump.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that too. I mean, I more than one time in that room, I thought, I can't escape. Their desk and chairs blocking the door. So I can't run out and I can't jump out. So here we are, just stuck, you know. So I don't know how you feel about getting bad news, but
oh, I love it.
Yeah, right.
Huge fan of the bad news.
Exactly, line you up, right? Right.
So you chose to have a double mastectomy, I understand, even though only one breast was affected by cancer, and that's such an interesting decision to make. What did that mean for you? Like, where did that take you, and why did you make that decision?
Yeah, you know, for me, I mean, every decision about cancer treatment is always deeply personal. So I would never judge another person's decision. I feel like it's got to be something, you know, within you to decide. I feel that way about all medical treatment, really. But for me, it was really about peace of mind, just not having to worry as much about, you know, next year's mammogram and potentially next year's biopsy and, you know, just the thought of like a whole lifetime of that stretching out before me was frankly terrifying. And I know double mastectomy doesn't mean that, you know, I won't ever have cancer again. But in my mind, I was like, let's go in here for the surgery and get it all done. And as much as we can. And my dad's a retired orthopedic surgeon. And he always says, when you're faced with cancer, you big C cancer, you throw everything you can at it while you can. And yep. So that's just what I did. I was like, I'm going scorched earth on this so that I don't look back and go, oh, what if? Why didn't I do that then? Like, you know, now I have another surgery. Like, I just wanted scorched earth, like, you know, as aggressive as possible, just to make sure it didn't come back.
Are you the type of person that would spend a lot of time researching the options, or were you relying more on the doctor's advice?
Yeah, you know, I did a little of both, but I'll be honest, when I, you know, went down that rabbit hole of WebMD, it was so terrifying. And
of course,
that it just sort of ramped up my anxiety. I spent a lot more time on my counselor's couch talking about how I felt about it to get to, you know, peace with the decision. I mean, the doctors were like, it's your call. You can do a double mastectomy. You can do a single one. You know, they really didn't weigh in heavily on what they thought I should do surgically. You know, they were just like, you need a mastectomy, a single one. And the double was really up to me. So I really had to talk to, you know, counselor and my spouse and friends and family to sort of get to my own personal decision about it. I don't know how you feel if you do the same.
Well, you know, I don't have a parallel experience, but I can tell you, I often use this show as part of the process when I'm dealing with issues, right? And I imagine the book for you is part of your process. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was so therapeutic and healing to write about it. I know I have several author friends who went through various forms of cancer, and some of them chose not to write about it. They just wanted to leave it in the past, like put it in a box and bury it and, you know, never look back. And I respect that decision. But, you know, for me, it really was therapeutic in writing and, you know, going through unpacking my emotions and trying to help others in that same spot so that, you know, when, you know, maybe someone else in the same situation might pick up this book, they'll feel less alone. And they'll feel less scared because they're connecting with someone else who's been there, been through it, and came out the other side. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
It makes 100% sense. I think that is a noble cause. And thank you very much for coming on the show today to explain it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Paul Roumeliotis, David Nelson, Brandy Hall, and Kara Lockwood. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic Newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic Newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.